And I am this morning's representative from the church board. I'm happy to welcome you here today on another cold morning. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please read the announcements listed in the order of service. And we also have a few others. I want you to know that today is the very last day that you can sign up for the winter retreat. So if you would do that, there's sign-up sheets in the social hall. I also have a stewardship update for you. Last week, we received 16 additional pledges, so we now have a total of 57 pledges, and people are continuing to show generous increases. The Canvas training is completed. We completed that last week, and 23 of our members dedicated 3 hours to this training to learn about the stewardship campaign and what is important to them and the church. Please welcome us when we call you asking to meet with you. Please get your pledges in as soon as possible. And the message continues to be to increase our pledging to fully support the full-time minister that we are calling. We now have, one more thing. New to the social area this week is a place for you to remember or learn about the history of Lake Country UU Church. There's a box of pictures and mementos for you to hang on that colorful piece. There are also cards for you to write messages and share memories. It is a truly interactive UU piece. The original photo album from the first years is left intact for you to leaf through, and I had the opportunity to do that this week, and it's really exciting to look through what was going on in those first few years. I encourage you to bring pictures of your own to celebrate our history. If you put your name on the back of them, I will try to return them to you. There are many recent events, like the fashion show, building the garden, Reverend Jane's stay here, that have no documentation that I could find. So if you have anything representing those events, it would be wonderful if you would bring those things in. And now we have an announcement about the children's stewardship drive to be given by Kaya Rollins.
Good morning. Hey, kids. Today we are celebrating our church stewardship campaign. But how does that include us? Good news. In the next few weeks, all the youth will be contributing to our own stewardship project. Every kid will design a note card based on one of the 7 UU principles for kids. Here's a refresher for all the adults on what they are. Number 1, each person is important. Number 2, be kind in all you do. Number 3, we're free to learn together. Number 4, we search for what is true. Number 5, all people need a voice. Number 6, build a fair and peaceful world. Number 7, we care for Earth's lifeboat. We will design the note cards, offer our creative talents time, and sell the note cards this year to contribute to the stewardship for our church and our faith. My mom, Chris Rollins, is organizing the project. Look for the project to begin in RE classes during the coming few weeks. Remember, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Thank you.
Thank you. I invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
If you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the table in the foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church. And Reverend Jim will be available in his office to meet with a small group of people. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the story for all ages, at which time they will go or can go to religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to the right and across the entranceway if there is a need for child care during the service. Classes end at 11:15, so please pick up your child by then. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them, or if any guests have brought themselves and you feel comfortable introducing yourself, please do so at this time. Well, welcome to all of you. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please remember to put your cell phones on silence, and I hope you find this morning service very inspiring. Thank you.
We are each and all called to a religious vocation. The work of the world is our common work. Today, this day, is our time and opportunity. The past is gone, and we cannot alter days past. The future has not come, and we do not live in the future. Today, this day, is ours. Ours to live, ours to choose. Today, here and now, lie our opportunities. Today we take up or we overlook our religious work. We have chosen our work for justice and peace, our work of forgiveness and reconciliation, our work of gratitude and generosity. Today, this day, we will fulfill the aspirations of the past. Today, we open the way to the future's promise. We are called. We have chosen to take up this work. Our work, the work of the world, is our religious vocation. And now let us join together in our opening hymn number 153, Oh, I Woke Up This Morning.
Open your books to 560 for our in-gathering. Commitment. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do.
All right, it's time for our story. So if the children would come up to the front, and any adults who feel like they'd like to see some nice pictures, can come up as well. I like the story for today. I hope you guys like it. Bethany. Like I said, it's got some nice pictures. It's called The Other Side. You want to come in closer so you can see? All right. Has anyone seen this book before? Sarah's seen it? In eighth grade. All right. Great. All right. That summer, the fence that stretched through our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it. I think I got to get this closer in. White people lived on the other side. And Mama said, "Don't climb over that fence when you play." She said it wasn't safe. That summer, there was a girl who wore a pink sweater. Each morning, she climbed up on the fence and stared over at our side. Sometimes, I stared back. She never sat on that fence with anybody. That girl didn't. Can you see her and you can see the girl on the fence? Once, when we were jumping rope, she asked if she could play. And my friend Sandra said no, without even asking the rest of us. I don't know what I would have said. Maybe yes, maybe no. That summer, everyone and everything on the other side of that fence seemed far away. When I asked my mama why, she said, "Because that's the way things have always been." Sometimes when me and mama went into town, I saw that girl with her mama. She looked sad sometimes, that girl did. "Don't stare," my mama said. "It's not polite." It rained a lot that summer. On rainy days, that girl sat on the fence in a raincoat. She let herself get all wet and acted like she didn't even care. Sometimes I saw her dancing in the puddles, splashing and laughing. Mama wouldn't let me go out in the rain. "That's why I bought you rainy day toys," my mama said. "You stay inside here where it's warm and safe and dry." But every time it rained, I looked for that girl. And I always found her somewhere on the fence, or somewhere near the fence. Someplace in the middle of the summer, the rain stopped. When I walked outside, the grass was damp and the sun was already high up in the sky, and I stood there with my hands up in the air. I felt brave that day. I felt free. I got close to the fence, and that girl asked me my name. "Clover," I said. "My name's Annie," she said. "Annie Paul. I live over yonder," she said, "by where you see the laundry. That's my blouse hanging on the line." She smiled then. She had a pretty smile. And then I smiled. And we stood there, looking at each other, smiling. "It's nice up on this fence," Annie said. "You can see all over." I ran my hand along the fence. I reached up and touched the top of it. "A fence like this was made for sitting on," Annie said. She looked at me sideways. "My mama says I shouldn't go over on the other side," I said. "My mama says the same thing, but she never said nothing about sitting on it." "Neither did mine," I said. That summer, me and Annie sat together on that fence. And when Sandra and them looked at me funny, I just made believe I didn't care. Some mornings, my mama watched us. I waited for her to tell me to get down from that fence before I break my neck or something, but she never did. I see you made a new friend, she said one morning, and I nodded, and Mama smiled. That summer, me and Annie sat on that fence and watched the whole wide world around us. One day, Sandra and them were jumping rope near the fence, and we asked if we could play. I don't care, said Sandra. And when we jumped, Sandra and me were partners, the way we used to be. When we were too tired to jump anymore, we sat up on the fence, all of us, in a long line. Someday, somebody's going to come along and knock down this old fence, Annie said. And I nodded. Yeah. Someday. What do you think? You like that story? You think it might have a little more to do than maybe just talking about a fence? Maybe you guys can talk about that in RE today. So we're going to go off to RE now, and Abby's going to carry the lantern, and we're going to sing hymn number 118, This Little Light of Mine, as you guys go out.
Don't start to leave until we've sung the first two stanzas, okay? And then you can leave on the third stanza.
Okay, then we'll have to go get our hymnal so we know the words, maybe.
Well, we know the words.
All right.
The first stanza is This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine. So, we can all sing that, can't we? This Little Light of Mine, I'm Going to Let It Shine. Let's go. Everywhere I go.
Everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine. Everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine. Everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine.
Building up a world. Then you can go to class now.
About what the congregation does not know about me, my response is my children. I learned during the canvassing training that many of you joined a church because of your children, and the same thing was true of Jeff and I. Aaron and Sam grew up in a United Methodist church. While I sometimes now question the logic of that, there are many people who supported them and cared about them. Sam and Aaron took the teachings and accepted some and they discarded others. And they grew up to be intelligent, independent, compassionate, caring adults with a passion for social justice. My son, Sam, was fortunate to have a youth leader, Chuck Malone, and an associate pastor, Kelly Fowler, who celebrated diversity and accepted all of the youth for who they were. That is not to say that his Christian experience was not without challenges. I left the church when Sam graduated from high school for many reasons. But one important reason was that I could no longer be part of a religious institution that called my son a sinner and would deny him the right, when and if he chose it, to marry the man he loves. My son was in middle school 12 years ago, and gratefully, much has changed since then. But like all youth, he struggled with his own sexual awareness and identity. The path that he had to tread was different in some ways, but not in all. It was in middle school that the harassment and bullying became frequent. Even one of the teachers, who later became an assistant principal, harassed my son in class, probably unknowingly. I sometimes wonder if it would have been easier for Sam had he been a youth in this church. Would he have accepted himself sooner? Would his father and I have recognized this very special piece of him when he was younger? I don't know. Sam had many friends at First Church who loved him and leaders who helped him as he found his way. But there were also bullies, children and youth who attended Sunday school with him and were supposedly learning the lessons of Jesus. When I joined Lake Country UU Church, I made a very good friend whose son is gay, but younger than Sam. We shared stories and experiences and talked about parenting challenges that were unique to a smaller group. At one point during our talks, the mother guilt light started going off in my head. And I emailed Sam, and I said, "Was there anything we could have done differently? Should we have been there sooner? Would it have been easier for you if I had been an adult sponsor of the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Alliance that I'm very proud to say he started at Kettle Marine High School?" Sam wrote back, said, "Mom, first of all, no 13-year-old boy wants to talk about who he wants to have relations with, especially his mother. And yes, it would have been easier for him had I been a sponsor. But he had tremendous support from his teacher and mentor at Kettle Marine, Mrs. Caves. What was most important to Sam is that he said he always knew that whoever he brought home for Christmas, that his father and I would respect and accept that person and welcome him into our family the same way we did our son-in-law, Chad. And that's one of the most important things to me about this church. No matter who comes for Christmas or Yom Kippur or the water ceremony or whatever Sunday or whatever event or whoever you meet in the community, you will respect that person, not in spite of who they are, but because of who they are. And you will accept them and welcome them into this community because you are UUs, and that is what you believe, and that is what you do." Thank you.
Thank you.
Let us join together in a time of meditation and reflection, thoughtfulness and prayer. This is the day we are given. There is pure grace in this gift. We have done nothing to create it or to deserve it. This is our day, a gift to savor and to serve. Day by day, we are given opportunities to enjoy the world's bounty and beauty. We are given opportunities to serve the world's suffering and humiliation. Today, let us remember with gratitude our religious inheritance. Let us honor all those who, in their day, often at personal risk and sacrifice, served the cause of religious freedom and the way of human dignity and human worth for all people. We are called to this religious cause and way today. In gratitude, let generous offerings from our resources and talents support our church community's mission, faithful service toward the world's well-being. In the continuing service of the generations rests an assurance. The way of human dignity and the cause of religious freedom will be present today and tomorrow, lighting the way for us, lighting the way for our children and for our children's children, and for generations beyond our reckoning. And now, in silence, let us continue in this spirit of reflection and meditation and prayer. Amen. Let us join together singing with enthusiasm and with conviction, "We Shall Overcome." Number. Thank you. just over 5 years ago, in January of 2008, following the controversy that arose around a sermon by Jeremiah Wright, our president's minister at the time, then presidential candidate Barack Obama delivered a speech in Philadelphia across the street from Constitution Hall. Mr. Obama began with a familiar quote from the United States Constitution, "We, the people, in order to form a more perfect union." And in part, here is what followed this opening. Candidate Obama said, "Race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. The fact is that the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through, a part of our union that we have yet to perfect. And if we walk away now, if we simply retreat into our respective corners, we will never be able to come together and solve challenges like healthcare or education or the need to find good jobs for every American. Working together, we can move beyond some of our own racial wounds. In fact, we have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union." These words were part of a profound and elegant statement regarding the unresolved issues of race that have plagued the United States since Europeans came to these shores and claimed an America already populated by Native peoples and nations. Soon thereafter, white Americans brought enslaved black Africans to this continent and to this hemisphere. In November 2008, Barack Obama, son of a black African father and a white Kansas mother, a black American of multiracial ancestry, was elected president of the United States. One of President Obama's cabinet appointments was Eric Holder, an African American chosen as his attorney general. In February of 2009, Mr. Holder delivers a speech marking Black History Month that he gave to the staff of the U.S. State Department. Mr. Holder charged that in regards to addressing race, we are, as he said, essentially a nation of cowards. He challenged Americans to leave our race-protected cocoons. Mr. Holder urged Americans to confront an uncomfortable but necessary task, speaking to one another across the deep cultural divide of learned ways and accepted responses set in place and maintained for hundreds of years in America. This morning, I make one small effort to further the spirit of the challenge that President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder put before us. Here in Heartland, at the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church, I speak primarily to a white congregation, but in no way does this reduce the importance for me and for you to leave our race-protected cocoons and to speak candidly to one another. Indeed, in significant ways, our shared white identity increases the importance. Yesterday, the Chicago Tribune carried an article about the effort of the Native American and Indigenous Student Alliance movement at Northwestern University, their effort to bring out an historically accurate account of the life of John Evans, one of the founders and benefactors of Northwestern University. In 1864, John Evans was the territorial governor of Colorado. And that year in Denver, a white militia of about 700 members was raised, and they rode out to eastern Colorado's Kiowa County. On the eastern Colorado plains near Sand Creek, without warning, they attacked a temporary encampment of peaceful Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho people, killing somewhere between 165 and 200 Native Americans, about two-thirds of them women, children, and elderly. Now, John Evans was not directly involved in this genocide. However, as governor of the territory, he had allowed and he had perhaps encouraged the recruitment of the militia. And after their slaughter on the plains, he tried to cover up the massacre. These Northwestern students are demanding an accurate account by Northwestern University of John Evans' involvement in this slaughter. Alongside this account, there was a second article which tells of other prominent American universities, among them Amherst, Yale, Brown, Harvard, Columbia, Barnard, Rice, Washington University in St. Louis, Washington and Lee, just a few of those universities whose white namesakes or founders were slave owners, or they were slave traders, or they were businessmen north and south in this nation engaged in the slave economy, or they were promoters of Native American genocide. These dark histories of prominent and celebrated white Americans have been largely submerged and covered up in telling their stories and in giving an account, an accurate account of our American history and culture. It is always a good time to set the record straight, and Black History Month offers one such opportunity. In the late 1930s, the Black American poet Langston Hughes published his poem, Let America Be America Again. It begins, "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me," says Hughes. February is Black History Month, and my sermon title, A White Looks at the Black American Experience, is in honor of the contributions of Black Americans to our nation and to all of our lives. Well, in my mind, and perhaps in yours, a question demands an answer. Is it not presumptuous of me, a white man, to speak about the Black American experience? Well, let me make 2 points in answering this question. First, I cannot and I will not speak for the Black American experience. That would be presumptuous. I think I can speak about the Black America experience and speak appreciatively. And that is because of a second point. The history and the destiny of Black Americans and white Americans are so intertwined that we cannot separate one from the other. Indeed, it has been the historic white error, the historic white sin, and a historic violation that was incorporated originally into the United States Constitution to try and separate the Black experience from the white experience. Whether legalized by slavery or legalized by Jim Crow segregation or by current more subtle legal and extra-legal means, white Americans have sought to maintain through their power and privilege the domination and oppression of Black Americans and other peoples of color. Now, let me make clear, I'm not saying this is true of all individual white Americans, but it is true of our American institutions and communities and cultures. Now, to be sure, even the most rabid racist segregationist does not want totally to separate Black from white. In the life arenas where segregation was and is advantageous for whites, so-called separationists practice subjugation of Blacks, economic subjugation, voting and citizenship subjugation, religious, social, and perhaps most insidious cultural subjugation, but they don't practice total separation. Cultural subjugation led to what Ralph Ellison termed in his novel, The Invisible Man. Black Americans were present, but they were not seen. They were invisible to white America. A story from my own experience illustrates the point. I was born in Enterprise, a small town in southeast Alabama, and at that time it was a farm service community in country where cotton once had been king. When I was a boy, cotton was still an important product. However, peanuts had become important too. Two of my most sharply etched childhood memories are connected with cotton and with peanuts. I remember seeing the heavy laden cotton wagons bringing their white bowls from the farms where they had been hand-picked into town to be ginned for processing. Cotton bowls and cotton fibers littered the streets and the roads. They were lifted by the wind into the air and came to rest on trees and houses and on people's clothing and in their hair. The economy of the town had been established, and it was built on cotton. However, by the late 1930s, peanuts were challenging and replacing cotton as the primary product. Unlike cotton, which depleted the soil, peanuts enriched the soil with nitrogen. Unlike cotton, which led to soil erosion, peanuts held the soil in place. Unlike the cotton crop, which was often devastated by the boll weevil infestation, peanuts were a much more reliable product. In Enterprise, there was a large peanut processing plant, which turned raw peanuts into peanut butter and peanut oil and a host of other useful and profitable products, and the pleasant odor of peanuts permeated the air throughout town. Enterprise claimed the title Home of the Boll Weevil Monument. Have any of you ever heard of the Boll Weevil Monument? Have any of you ever seen the Boll Weevil Monument? Well, let me tell you about the Boll Weevil Monument. The major crossroads at the center of town in Enterprise are Main Street and College Street. And in the middle of this intersection, there is a large enclosed pool inhabited by goldfish. And in the center of the pool is a pedestal. And on the top of the pedestal stands a white-gowned female figure, and her hands are raised high above her head, and in her hand she holds a platter upon which rests the model of a boll weevil. And this is the Boll Weevil Monument. In 1915, more than 60% of the cotton crop was destroyed by the boll weevil. And in that situation, farmers began to turn to peanuts as an alternative crop. And by 1917, more peanuts were raised in Coffee County, Alabama, the county where Enterprise is, than any other county in the United States. And so in 1919, the citizens of Enterprise erected the boll weevil statue. And the inscription that is set on this monument reads, "In profound appreciation of the boll weevil and what it has done as the herald of prosperity, this monument was erected by the citizens of Enterprise, Coffee County, Alabama." Now here is the profound irony of the boll weevil monument. The reason that peanuts were such a profitable crop was the result of the research of Black American scientist George Washington Carver. Probably all of you have heard of George Washington Carver. As you may know, Dr. Carver spent most of his long career at Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, in Tuskegee, Alabama. And there he developed more than 300 uses for peanuts, including peanut butter, and many uses for other agricultural products as well. And out of these many inventions, he sought only 3 patents, because George Washington Carver believed that the products of nature were gifts from God that were provided for everyone. In Alabama and throughout America, as a black man, George Washington Carver was invisible. There were no statues or monuments erected to him in 1919, nor for many years thereafter. Now, I grew up hearing the story of the boll weevil. However, I was in college before I knew the full story about George Washington Carver. When I learned of his research on peanuts, it dawned on me, oh, Dr. Carver was responsible for the use and the profitability of peanuts, not the boll weevil. Why didn't I learn that as a boy? Langston Hughes continues in his poem, "Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free, that land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me. Who made America? whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hands at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. The kind of black invisibility illustrated by the erection of the boll weevil monument has been characteristic in America. Most white Americans choose to live most of their lives in a carefully controlled white environment. White Americans choose to live in a kind of enclosed white bubble. And most of those invited inside the bubble are white. And if they're not white, most have been chosen to come in to serve white people. And only a few of the people of color admitted enter with an equal status to the whites. Now, of course, this is not described as racial discrimination or segregation. It is sanitized with non-racial language and colorblind words, but this cannot hide the obvious reality that the white bubble is carefully guarded to keep many people out. And the white bubble is seen in residential communities, in schools, in work environments, in churches, and other religious communities, in government, in recreation, in social institutions. A result of the white bubble is not only social and physical separation, there is in addition a kind of psychic and emotional segregation which obscures and hides the life circumstances of black Americans and other people of color. This white instituted and white maintained institutional, psychic, and emotional segregation distorts and damages the lives of white people as well as people of color. It creates a large and destructive hole in our souls and minds, in the very being we have. And it creates as well a destructive hole at the center of all our American institutions and communities. Now, in reality, the white bubble is not built on solid rock, but on mushy landfill. And in social upheaval or crisis, it will crumble and it will fall. It is like the gated, wealthy vacation complex that exists in third world countries and now in America too, closed off from the poverty around them. But when the tsunami arrives, rich and poor alike will be swept away. It is, of course, possible for whites to get out of the white bubble, to choose to enter the real world. However, it is not easy, and it goes against the grain of achieving the mythological great American dream. Choosing to enter the real world is likely to be misunderstood and questioned, both by whites and by blacks. Nevertheless, to enter the real world is to be given the opportunity to recognize and experience the commonality of all human life. Entering the real world is to realize that one's destiny is the same as the destiny of all people, and therefore our common interest is also the same. Langston Hughes continues, "Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Meanwhile, in the white bubble, the contributions of Black Americans to this country and to the world are ignored and played down. And the atrocities committed by white Americans and white society are covered up or downplayed, as we discovered in the newspaper articles in yesterday's Chicago Tribune. Both white Americans and Black Americans have to dig deep if we are to get the true story. This is a major theme of the Black American experience, and it has a destructive impact on all of us, whether we are white or Black or of some other racial identity. One reason for all of us to observe Black History Month is to regain and reclaim the accurate story. And another reason is to know that it is our common story, and to remember that it is our common responsibility as American citizens to extend to all the rightful claims of full citizenship. In the past and in the present, Black Americans and other people of color have been the leaders in keeping this agenda before us. Langston Hughes continues, out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the lands, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains and the endless plain, and all the stretch of these great green states, and make America again. Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. When Langston Hughes writes, America never was America to me, he speaks for all of America's dispossessed. And when he writes, America will be, he speaks for the vision of America in which every man and woman and child is valued. He speaks for a vision of equal American citizenship and community among all its people. Langston Hughes, of course, was a Black American, speaking out of his Black American experience, and yet he spoke on behalf of all Americans. Langston Hughes had a vision more true to Thomas Jefferson's great vision and the great vision of all the founders than the founders had themselves in framing the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. He had a vision more true to the great vision of Abraham Lincoln and the great vision of all who stood for the Union and the dissolution of slavery than they had themselves. He had a vision more true to Franklin Roosevelt's great vision of the four freedoms and the fair deal than Roosevelt and his supporters had. Langston Hughes is representative of a mighty host of oppressed and dispossessed Black Americans and other Americans of color who call this American nation their home and who call the American people to stand for our claimed American vision. And that is why he and so many others are important to me and important to all of us. They call us back to the American vision, to speak for our common vision, to struggle and support our common vision and to give our lives to our common vision. It is an inclusive vision, a vision for all the people that transcends narrow self-serving interests. Inclusive or exclusive, you and I live out our lives every day at home, among friends and family and acquaintances, in churches and social clubs and service organizations, at school, at work, in our neighborhoods, our cities, our nation. And in all these places, the question for us to ponder any time, but perhaps especially this Black History Month, is this: whatever our race, our ethnicity, or status, what are we doing to fulfill the vision that Langston Hughes puts before us? As he puts it, oh, let America be America again, that land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where everyone is free. This is a religious question of the highest order. This is a civic question of the greatest importance, and it is our question, a common question, that can help us get out of our race-protected cocoons in which we spend so much of our lives, to get outside and to come face to face with one another. In the short term, we cannot completely bring down the walls of racism of America, in America and around the world. But we can make cracks, and we can punch holes in that wall, and ultimately, the wall will be undermined, and the wall will come tumbling down. I doubt that any of us in this room today will live to see that great day. But if we do our part today, if we live our faith today, rest assured that one of these days the wall will come tumbling down. Blessed be that day, and blessed be all who work today toward the great day when the racist wall comes tumbling down. Amen.
Now is the time in our service where we have our offertory. Our greeters will pass the baskets. Today is the monthly food pantry collection for the North Lake Food Pantry. Loose cash donations will go to the food pantry. Checks can be made out to LCUUC with the amounts for the food pantry and for LUUC noted on the memo line. If you brought food contributions, please place them in a basket in the foyer. Thank you.
Tracy, thank you so much for your choices of music today. I really have appreciated them, as I'm sure everyone has today. And now I would like to invite the people whose names appear in this order of service today, and their kids can come forward too, and if they would come stand here, bring your order of service with you, and come stand here facing the congregation. And on the other side, we'll have our congregational president, as well as two representatives of the membership committee, and I standing. As minister of the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church, I welcome you new members of the congregation. And in a like manner, Barbara Huell, the president of the Board of Trustees, welcomes you on the behalf of the congregation, and Mark Brewer welcomes you on behalf of the membership committee, as does Chris White, although she doesn't have any spoken words today.
In this ceremony, the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church enacts the renewal of life of our religious congregation. In the presence of the congregation, these new members sign the membership book. In turn, the congregation welcomes them and offers encouragement and support in their ongoing religious life and growth.
Oh, welcome.
Every member agrees to make his or her contribution toward the well-being of our religious community, taking a share of the work and the financial support necessary to keep the congregation vital and dynamic in its life and service.
Every member in a Unitarian Universalist congregation makes a free choice to join his or her life with the religious community. Are you new members now ready to affix your names to the membership book? Yes, you are. Well, if you will look in your order of service, you will find some words there for you to say together in unison. Okay, congregation, now you have your part, which is also in the order of service.
We too
make our promises to you.
We invite you to walk with us in the way of respect and freedom. Our bonds are forged in trust through our promises one to another. We seek to walk together in the spirit of mutual support and care, for in difference we against the human spirit.
We warmly welcome you into our ranks. As symbols of this important occasion, we offer you the right hand of fellowship, a candle, and a new member packet.
So you can come forward one by one and sign your names, and then we will give you some gifts, and we will shake your hand. Thank you. Audacious religious testimony. The unity of the human spirit undergirds and binds together diverse and marvelous and sometimes contradictory human ways. Now, as we go forth, let us be confident in the faith we can help build a world wherein the many peoples are known to be one humanity with one common destiny. Amen.